Very well for my lord's breakfast in Abu Dhar. And the best smoked tongue, my lord. If my lord only knew what I went through to find honey-smoked tongue in that wretched village, with no time to find anything, and all the best taken by the eyes that I... Actually, his biggest grievance seemed to be that Lopin had found potted larks for Nalesian. Every time Nalesian crunched one between his teeth, Lopin's smug smile grew wider and Nerim's face grew longer. For that matter, it was plain from the way some of the men sniffed the air that they would rather have had a slice of lamb and a bowl of soup than any amount of honey-smoked tongue or goose-liver pudding. Alvar stared at the women's fire with open wistfulness. "You want to eat with them?" Matt asked him. "It's all right if you do."
"I like kippered eel," Oliver said stoutly. In a darker tone he added, "Anyway, she might put something in it."
His eyes followed Avienda every time she shifted, and he seemed to have taken against the hunter, too, perhaps because she spent a good bit of time in obviously friendly chat with the Aiel woman. Avienda at least must have felt the boy's stare because she glanced at him and frowned. Wiping his chin and eyeing the Aes Sedai's fire, come to think of it, he would rather have had lamb and soup himself, Matt noticed that Jam was missing. Vannin grumped about being sent out again, but Matt sent him for the same reason. He had had the man scout ahead during the day, despite the fact that Jam did too. He did not want to rely on what the Aes Sedai chose to tell him. He might have trusted Nynaeve. He did not think she would actually lie to him. As wisdom, Nynaeve had always been death on anyone lying. But she kept peeping at him past Adelius's shoulder in a very suspicious way. To his surprise, Elaine rose as soon as she finished eating and came gliding across that invisible line. Some women just seemed to skim over the ground.
"Will you walk aside with me, Master Cawthon?" she asked coolly. Not polite exactly, but not exactly rude either.
He motioned her to lead the way, and she floated out into the moon-shadowed trees beyond the sentries. That golden hair nestled about her shoulders, framing a face to make any man stare, and the moonlight softened her arrogance. If she had been anything but what she was, and he did not mean just Aes Sedai, nor even that she belonged to Rand. Rand did seem to be tangling himself with the worst sort of woman for a man who had always known how to handle them. Then Elaine began talking, and he forgot everything else.
"You have a Tirangrial," she said without preamble and without looking at him.
She just glided along, rustling the leaves on the ground as if she expected him to heel like a hunting hound.
"Some hold that Tirangrial are rightfully the property of Aes Sedai, but I do not require you to surrender it. No one will take it from you. Such things need study, however. For that reason, I want you to give the Tirangrial to me each evening when we stop. I will return it each morning before we start out."
Matt gave her a sidelong look. She was serious, no doubt about it.
"That's very kind of you, letting me keep what's mine. Only what makes you think I have one of these... what did you call it? A tur-something?"
Oh, she did stiffen up at that, and look at him, too. He was surprised not to see fire leap from her eyes to lighten up the night. Her voice, on the other hand, was purest crystal ice.
"You know very well what a Tirangrial is, Master Cawthon. I heard Moraine speak of them to you in the Stone of Tyr."
"The stone," he said blandly. "Yes, I remember the stone. A fine time we all had there. Do you remember something in the stone that gives you a right to make demands of me?"
"I don't.
I'm just here to keep you and Nynaeve from getting holes poked in your hides in Abu Dhar. You can ask Rand about Tirangrial after I deliver you to him."
For a long moment she stared at him as though meaning to beat him down by force of will, then turned on her heel without another word. He followed her back to the camp and was surprised to see her walk along the line of hobbled horses. She examined the fires and how the blankets were laid out, shook her head over the remains of the trooper's meal. He had no idea what she was about until she returned to him with her chin raised.
"Your men have done very well, Master Cawthon," she said, loud enough for everyone to hear. "In general, I am more than satisfied. But if you had planned ahead properly, they would not have had to gorge themselves on foods that will at the very least keep them awake tonight. Still, on the whole, you have done well. I'm sure you will think ahead in future."
"Cool as you please," she strode back to her own fire before he could say a word, leaving him staring.
Had that been the whole of it, though, the bloody daughter heir thinking he was one of her subjects, and her and Nynaeve tight-lipped around Van Deen and Adelais, had that been all, he would have danced a jig. Right after Elaine's inspection, before he could even reach his blankets, the foxhead went cold. He was so shocked that he stood there staring down at his chest before he even thought to look toward the Aes Sedai's fire. There they stood in a row along that unseen dividing line, Avienda as well. Elaine murmured something he could not make out, and the two white-haired Aes Sedai nodded. Adelais, all the while hastily dipping a pen in an ink jar in a sort of scabbard at her belt, and jotting notes in a small book. Nynaeve was tugging her braid and muttering to herself. It only lasted a few moments altogether. Then the chill faded, and they returned to their fire, talking softly among themselves. Now and then one of them would glance in his direction until he finally bedded himself down. The second day they joined a road, and Jaehaerm put his color-shifting cloak away. It was a broad stretch of hard-packed dirt, where sometimes an edge of old paving stone still showed, but the highway did not make travel that much faster. For one thing, it curved through increasingly hilly forest. Some of those hills deserve the name of small mountain, at least, jagged things with sheer cliffs and stony spires sticking up through the trees. For another, a thin yet steady stream of people drifted in both directions, mostly clumps of grubby, blank-faced folk who barely seemed to have sense to step out of the way of a farmer's high-wheeled ox cart, much less a merchant's train with its canvas-topped wagons clipping along behind teams of 6 or 8 horses. Farmhouses and barns of pale stone appeared clinging to the slopes of the hills, and midway through the third day, they saw the first village of white-plastered buildings with flat roofs of pale reddish tile. The pinpricks kept up, though. Elaine continued her evening inspections, when he told her sarcastically that he was glad she was pleased in the second night's camp beside the road. She smiled one of those deliberate, regal smiles and said, "You should be, Master Cawthon," sounding as if he had meant every word. Once they began stopping at inns, she inspected the horses in the stables and the troopers' sleeping places in the lofts. Asking her not to brought a coolly arched eyebrow and no answer. Telling her not to brought not even the eyebrow. She just plain ignored him altogether. She told him to do things he had already decided to do, such as having all the horses' shoes checked at the first inn that had a farrier, and, more grating, things he would have seen to had he known of them before her. How she discovered Ted Candle was trying to hide a boil on his bottom, Matt did not know, or that Laudrin Mendair had no fewer than 5 flasks of brandy secreted in his saddlebags. Irritating did not begin to describe doing a thing after she told him to, but Candle's boil had to be lanced. Some of the band had adopted Matt's attitude toward being healed, and Mendar's brandy poured out, and a dozen things more. Matt almost prayed for her to tell him to do something that did not need doing, just once, so he could tell her no. Emphatically, absolutely, no! Another demand for the Turangriel would have been perfect, but she never mentioned it again. He explained to the troopers that they had no obligation to obey her, and he never actually caught one at it, but they began grinning in a pleased way at her compliments and how well they cared for their horses, and puffed out their chests when she told them they looked like good soldiers to her. The day Matt saw Vannin knuckle his forehead to her, heard him murmur, "Thank you, my lady," without a trace of irony, that day Matt nearly swallowed his tongue. He tried to be pleasant, but none of the women were having any, not just Elaine. Avienda told him that he had no honor, of all things, and if he could not show more respect to Elaine, she herself would undertake to teach him respect. Avienda! The woman he still suspected was waiting her chance to slit Elaine's throat. She called Elaine her near-sister.
Van Deen and Adelius peered at him as if he were a strange bug pinned to a board. He offered to shoot with the hunter for coin, or the fun of it. The bow she carried must have fevered her imagination. Her name as hunter was Brigitta. But she just gave him a very odd look and declined. For that matter, she stayed clear of him after that. She stuck to Elaine's side like a burr, except when Elaine came near him. And Nynaeve? All the way from Saladar she avoided him as if he smelled bad. Their third night on the way, the first at an inn, a little place called the Marriage Knife, Matt saw her in the tile-roofed stable, feeding a wizened carrot to her plump mare, and decided that whatever else was going on, he could at least talk to her about Bode. It was not every day a man's sister went off to become Aes Sedai, and Nynaeve would know what Bode was facing. "Nynaeve," he said, striding toward her, "I want to talk to you." He got no further. She practically leaped straight up in the air and came down shaking a fist at him, though she immediately hid it in a fold of her skirts.
"You leave me alone, Matt Cawthon," she all but shouted. "Do you hear me? You leave me alone!"
And she scurried out, sidling past him and bristling so that he expected to see her braid stand up like a cat's tail. After that, he not only smelled bad, he had some sickness that was both loathsome and catching. If he so much as tried to come nearer, she hid behind Elaine and glared at him past the other woman's shoulder for all the world as if she was about to stick her tongue out at him. Women were plain mad, that was all. At least Tom and Julin were willing to ride alongside him during the day, whenever Elaine did not demand their attention. She did sometimes, just to keep them away from him, he was sure, though he could not fathom the why. Once they found inns, the pair were more than happy to share a mug of ale or punch with him and Elysian of an evening. They were country common rooms, brick-walled and quiet, where watching a brindle cat was the entertainment, and the innkeeper herself served table, inevitably a woman with hips that looked as though a man's fingers might break trying a pinch. The talk was of Ebu Dar mainly, of which Tom knew a good deal despite never having been there. Nalesian was more than willing to recount his one visit there, as often as asked, though he wanted to focus on duels he had seen and the gambling on horse races. Julin had stories from men who knew men who had been there, if not three or four removed, that sounded beyond belief until Tom and Nalesian confirmed them. Men fought duels over women in Ebu Dar, and women over men, and in both cases the prize, that was the word used, agreed to go with the winner. Men gave women a knife when they married, asking her to use it to kill him if he displeased her. Displeased her! And a woman killing a man was considered justified unless it was proven differently. In Ebu Dar, men walked small around women and forced a smile at what they would kill another man for. Elaine would love it. So would Nynaeve. Something else came out in those talks. Matt had not imagined Nynaeve and Elaine's displeasure at Van Deen and Adelius, however they tried to hide it. Nynaeve apparently contented herself with glaring and mumbling under her breath. Elaine did not frown or mutter, but she did continually try to take charge. She seemed to think she was already Queen of Andor. However many years those Aes Sedai faces hid, Van Deen and Adelius had to be old enough to be the younger women's mothers, if not grandmothers. Matt would not have been surprised to learn they were Aes Sedai when Nynaeve and Elaine were born. Even Tom could not fathom the tension, and he did seem to comprehend a great many things for a simple gleeman. Elaine had snapped Tom's nose off and told him he did not understand and could not, when he tried to remonstrate with her gently. It seemed the two older Aes Sedai were remarkably tolerant. Adelius often did not appear to register the fact when Elaine gave orders, and both she and Van Deen seemed surprised when they did notice. Van Deen said, "Well, if you really want to, child, of course we will," Julin muttered into his ale, recounting one incident. "You would think somebody who was only accepted just a few days ago would be pleased.
Elaine's eyes reminded me of a winter storm. Nynaeve ground her teeth so hard, I thought they'd crack.
They were in the common room of the marriage knife. Vannon and Harnan and others occupied benches at other tables, together with a number of locals. The men were in long vests, some bright enough for a tinker, and often with no shirt. The women in pale dresses with deep, narrow necklines, their skirts gathered up to the knee on one side to expose petticoats colorful enough to make the vests fade. Many of the men and all of the women wore large hoop earrings, and on their hands usually three or four rings sparkling with colored glass. Men and women alike fingered long, curved knives, stuck through their belts, and eyed the strangers darkly. There were two merchants' trains from Amadicia stopped at the marriage knife, but the merchants had eaten in their rooms, and their drivers remained with the wagons. Elaine and Nynaeve and the rest of the women were upstairs, too.
"Women are different," Nalesian said, laughing, in response to Julin,
though he directed the words at Matt, fingering the point of his beard. He was not usually so stiff with commoners, but Julin was a tyrant commoner, and that seemed to make a difference, especially since Julin made a point of staring when he spoke to him.
"There's a peasant saying in Tyr, an Aes Sedai is 10 women in one skin. Peasants have a good bit of wisdom sometimes, burn my soul if they don't."
"At least no one has done anything, shall we say, drastic," Tom said, though I thought it was close when Elaine let slip that she had made Brigida her first warder.
"The Hunter?"
Matt exclaimed. Several of the locals looked at him hard, and he lowered his voice.
"She's a warder as well? Elaine's warder?"
"That certainly explained a few things." Tom and Julin exchanged looks over the rims of their mugs.
"She will be gratified to know you puzzled out that she is a hunter for the horn," Tom said, wiping ale from his mustaches. "Yes, she is. And a right set to it nearly caused, too. Jem took her right away like a younger sister. But Van Deen and Adelius..."
He sighed heavily.
"Neither was very pleased Elaine had already chosen a warder. Apparently most Aes Sedai go years before finding one. And they especially were not pleased she chose a woman. And their not being pleased has Elaine's back up even more."
"They don't seem to like doing things that have not been done before," Julin added.
"A woman warder,"
Nalesian muttered.
"I knew everything would change with a dragon reborn, but a woman warder?"
Matt shrugged.
"I suppose she'll do well enough, as long as she really can shoot that bow."
"Down the wrong hole?"
he asked Julin, who had begun choking on his ale.
"Give me a good bow over a sword any day. Better a quarterstaff, but a bow is just fine. I only hope she doesn't try to get in my way when it's time to take Elaine to Rand."
"I think she can shoot it."
Tom leaned across the table to slap Julin on the back.
"I think she can, Matt."
But if Nynaeve and the others had any thoughts of hair-pulling, and Matt would not want to be within 10 miles of that, foxhead or no, they showed none of it to him. All he saw was a solid front and more attempts to channel at him, beginning while he was saddling Pips the morning after the first attempt. Luckily, he was busy fending off Nerim, who thought saddling Matt's horse was his job, and implied he could do it better, and the flash of cold lasted only a moment, so Matt gave no outward indication that he had noticed anything at all. That, he determined, would be his response. No stares, no glares, no accusations. He would ignore them and let them cook in their own broth. He had plenty of opportunity to ignore them. The silver medallion went cold twice more before they found the road, then several times more during the day, that evening, and every day and evening thereafter. Sometimes it came and went in two blinks of an eye, and sometimes he was sure it went on for an hour. He could never tell which one was responsible, of course, or usually not. Once, when the heat had given him a rash on his back and the scarf around his neck seemed about to saw his head off, He caught Nynaeve looking at him when the medallion grew cold. She was scowling so hard that a passing farmer, who was poking his ox with a stick, trying to make the animal lumber faster, peered over his shoulder at her as though he feared that gaze might turn on him any moment and maybe kill his ox in the cart shafts. Only when Matt scowled back at her, she gave a jump and almost fell out of her saddle, and the chill vanished. For the rest, he just could not say. At times, he might see two or three of them watching him, including Avienda, who was still walking and leading her horse. Others, by the time he peeked, were talking among themselves or looking at an eagle drifting across the cloudless sky, or a great black bear, half again as tall as a man, standing among the trees on a steep hillside inside of the road. The only truly good thing in it was that he got the impression Elaine was not pleased. He did not know why, and he did not care. Inspecting his men, patting him on the head with compliments. If he had been the kind of man to do that sort of thing, he would have kicked her. In truth, though, he began to feel more than a little smug. Whatever they were doing, it had no effect on him that a touch of one of Nerim's ointments rubbed onto his chest could not cure. Nerim assured him it was not frostbite. He felt smug until the fourth afternoon. He was making his way from stabling Pips to the southern hoop, a scruffy two stories of white-plastered bricks in a scruffy village of white-plastered bricks and flies called Sotahar, when something soft hit him squarely between the shoulders. With the smell of horse dung in his nostrils, he spun around, ready to chew a hole in a stable boy, or one of the Sotahar's sullen-eyed louts, knife or no knife. There was no stable boy and no lout, only Adelias, busily scribbling away in her little book and nodding to herself. Her hands were quite clean. Matt went inside and called for punch from the innkeeper, then changed his mind and had her bring brandy instead. A cloudy liquid, the lanky woman insisted, was made from plums, but which tasted as if it might remove rust. Julin contented himself with a sniff, and Tom would not even do that. Even Elysian only took one sip before asking for punch, and Elysian would drink anything. Matt lost count of how many of the tiny pewter cups he emptied, but however many it was, it took Nerim and Lopin together to get him to bed. He had never really let himself think whether the foxhead had any limits. He had proof and more than enough that it would stop Sidar, but if all they had to do was pick something up with the power and throw it at him... Better than nothing, he kept telling himself, lying on his lumpy mattress and watching moon shadows crawl across the ceiling. A lot better than nothing. But if he had been able to stand by himself, he would have gone back down for more brandy. Which was why he was in a vile temper, with a tongue that seemed coated with feathers and a head that had drummers pounding away inside and sweat pouring down him from the sun overhead, when the road topped a rise on the fifth day to reveal Ebu Dar, spread out below, straddling the broad river Eldar, with a great bay full of ships beyond. His first impression of the city was white. White buildings, white palaces, white towers and spires. Domes, like sharp white turnips or pears, often bore bands of crimson or blue or gold, but mainly the city was white, and reflected sunlight till it almost hurt his eyes. The gate the road led to was a broad, tall, pointed arch in a white-plastered wall so thick that he rode in shade for 20 paces before emerging into the sun again. It seemed to be a city of squares and canals and bridges. Large squares, full of people with fountains or statues in the center, canals broad and narrow with men poling barges along them, bridges in every size, some low, some arching high, some big enough that shops lined their sides. Palaces with thick columned porticos stood alongside shops displaying rugs and cloth. Houses of four stories with huge arched windows hidden behind louvered shutters stood beside stables and cutlers and fishmongers. It was in one of those squares that Vendine drew rein to confer with Adelius, while Nynaeve frowned at them and Elaine stared as if icicles should have been hanging from her nose and chin. At Elaine's urging, Avienda had climbed onto her lanky dun for the entry to the city, but now she scrambled down again, as awkwardly as she had climbed on. She looked about almost as curiously as Alvar, who had been wide-eyed since the city first came into view. Brigida seemed to be trying to heal Elaine, in imitation of J.M. with Van Deen. Matt took the opportunity to fan himself with his hat and look around. The largest palace he had seen yet filled one entire side of the square, old domes and spires and colonnades 3 and 4 stories above the ground. The other 3 sides mixed great houses with inns and shops, each as white as the next. A statue of a woman in flowing robes, taller than an ogier, stood on an even taller pedestal in the middle of the square, one arm raised to point south toward the sea. There were only a handful of people walking across the pale paving stones, and no wonder in that heat. A few were eating their midday meal on the lowest step of the pedestal, and pigeons and seagulls flocked about fighting for scraps. It was a picture of tranquility. Matt did not understand why he suddenly felt the dice rolling in his head. He knew that sensation well. Sometimes he felt it when his luck was running strong in the gambling. It was always there when a battle was in the offing. And it seemed to come when there was a vital decision to make, the sort where the wrong choice might well get his throat cut.
"We will go in now by one of the lesser gates," Van Deen announced.
Adelius was nodding.
"Merilil will see that we are given rooms to freshen."
That must mean this was the Tarasin Palace, where Tylin Quintara, of House Mitsobar, sat on the throne of the winds and ruled in truth maybe as much as 100 miles around Abu Dhar. One of the few things he had managed to learn about this trip was that the Aes Sedai were to meet one of their number in the palace, and of course Tylin. Aes Sedai would meet the queen. Matt looked at that great heap of gleaming marble and white-plastered stone, and he thought what it would be like to stay in there. He liked palaces, usually. At least, he liked anywhere with servants and gold, and feather beds did not hurt. But a royal palace meant nobles every time you turned around. Matt preferred nobles a few at a time. Even Elysian could be irritating. A palace that size meant either constant wondering where Nynaeve and Elaine were, or else an attempt to mount guard over them. He was not sure whether it would be worse if they let him tag along in there as a bodyguard or refused. He could almost hear Elaine saying in that cool voice,
"Pray find some accommodation for Master Cawthon and my men. See they are fed and watered."
She would do it, too. She would pop in for her inspections and tell him what to do, whatever he was already about to. Yet if she and Nynaeve were safe from trouble anywhere, it would be inside a queen's palace. Besides, what he wanted was somewhere he could put his feet up and drink punch with a girl on his knee to soothe his temples. Damp towels would be good. His head hurt. The prim-mouthed lecture Elaine had delivered that morning about the evils of drink and setting an example still rang in his ears. That was another reason he had to put his foot down. He had been too weak to reply, just out of bed and wondering whether he could heave himself onto Pips, and she had already gotten away with too much. If he did not put a stop to it now, she would have him knuckling his forehead. All that ran through his mind in the time it took Van Deen to turn her slab-sided bay gelding toward the palace.
"I'll take rooms at one of these inns for my men," he said loudly. "If you or Elaine mean to go out in the streets, Nynaeve, you can send word, and I'll bring a few men to walk you about."
They probably would not. Nobody could top a woman for thinking she could take care of herself in a bear pit with her bare hands. But he would wager Vannon could figure out a way to know when they went out. And if not, then Julin. A thief-catcher should know how.
"That one will do."
Choosing at random, he pointed to a wide building across the square. A sign he could not make out swung over the arched doorway. Van Deen looked at Adelius. Elaine looked at Nynaeve. Avienda frowned at him. He gave none of them a chance to speak, though.
"Tom, Julin,
What do you say to a few mugs of punch?
Maybe water would be better. He had never drunk that much before in his life.
Tom shook his head.
Later, perhaps, Matt. I should stay close in case Elaine needs me.
The almost fatherly smile he directed at her faded when he saw her staring nonplussed at Matt. Julian did not smile. He seldom did any more. But he, too, said he should stay close, maybe later.
"As you wish," Matt said, replacing his hat. "Vannon! Vannon!"
The fat man gave a start and stopped staring worshipfully at Elaine. He actually blushed. Light, the woman was a bad influence. As Matt turned pips, Elaine's voice hit him in the back, even more prim than that morning.
"You are not to let them drink to excess, Master Cawthon. Some men do not know when to stop. You should certainly not allow a young boy to see men in drink."
He gritted his teeth and rode on across the square without looking back. Oliver was looking at him. He was going to have to warn the men about getting drunk in front of the boy, especially Mendare. Light, but he hated her telling him what he should do. The inn turned out to be called the Wandering Woman, but the sign over the door and the common room promised everything that Matt wanted. The high-ceilinged room was certainly cooler than outside, with its wide arched windows screened behind wooden shutters carved into arabesques. There seemed to be more hole than wood, but they shaded the room. Outlanders sat among the locals, a lanky Mirandian with curling mustaches, a stout Kandori with two silver chains across the chest of his coat. Others Matt did not recognize offhand. A faint haze of pipe smoke filled the air, and two women playing shrill flutes and a fellow with a drum between his knees provided an odd sort of music. Best of all, the serving women were pretty, and men were tossing dice at four tables. The Kandori merchant was playing at cards. The stately innkeeper introduced herself as Satala Anan, though her hazel eyes had never been born in Ebudar.
"Good, my lords."
Large gold hoops in her ears swayed as she bowed her head equally to Matt and Elysian.
"May the wandering woman offer you her humble accommodation."
She was pretty, despite a touch of gray in her hair, but Matt watched her eyes. She wore a marriage knife hanging from a close-fitting necklace, the hilt set with red and white stones nestling in her generous cleavage. And she also had one of those curving knives in her belt. Still, he could not help grinning.
"Mistress Anan, I feel like I've come home."
The odd thing was, the dice had stopped rolling in his head.
Chapter 48. Leaning on the Knife. Climbing out of the big copper tub with a length of white toweling wrapped around her head, Nynaeve dried slowly. The plump, gray-haired serving woman tried to dress her, but Nynaeve sent her away, ignoring the startled looks and protests, and did it herself with great care, examining the dark green dress with its wide collar of pale Merada lace in the tall, narrow stand mirror. Lan's heavy gold ring lay in her pouch. Best not to think of that. Alongside one of the twisted ring Turangrial, and the great serpent gleamed golden around the third finger of her right hand. Her right hand. Best not to think of that, either. The high ceiling was quite pleasantly painted in blue sky and white clouds, and if the furnishings stood on disconcertingly large gilded lion feet, and the slim bedposts and chair legs and everything else vertical had too much fluting and gilding for her taste, it was still a more comfortable room than she had stayed in for some considerable time. A pleasant room, moderately cool. What she was trying to do was calm herself. It did not work, of course. She had felt Sidar being woven, and as soon as she stepped from her bedchamber, she saw the ward against eavesdropping Elaine had made and tied off around the sitting room. Birgitta and Avienda were already there as well, all of them freshly scrubbed and dressed. In what Birgitta claimed was a rather ordinary arrangement here, four bedchambers flanked the one sitting room, which also had a ceiling painted as sky and clouds. Four tall arched windows opened onto a long balcony of white-painted wrought iron, so intricate they could peer down from it unseen at the Malhara Square in front of the palace. A faint breeze stirred through the windows, carrying the salt scent of the sea, and for a wonder it actually was a little cool. Anger interfered with her concentration, and Nynaeve had been feeling the heat since shortly after arriving in the Tarasin Palace. Tom and Juelin had been given a room somewhere deep in the servants' quarters, which in truth seemed to irritate Elaine more than it did either of the men. Tom had actually laughed, but then he could afford to. "Have some of this excellent tea, Nynaeve," Elaine said, laying a white napkin across gleaming blue silk skirts. Like everything else in the sitting room, her wide chair had gilded balls for feet and more standing along the tall back above her head. Avienda sat by her side, but on the floor, legs folded beneath the skirt of a high-necked dress that almost matched the pale green tile. Her labyrinthine silver necklace went very well with the dress. Nynaeve did not think she had seen the Aiel woman sit in a chair once. People had certainly stared at her in those two inns. "Mint and cloudberries," Birgitta added to Elaine's offer, filling another delicate golden porcelain cup without waiting. Birgitta wore wide gray trousers and a short blue coat. She did wear dresses occasionally, but her taste made Nynaeve glad it was seldom. All three of them dressed and primped, and no one wanted them. The silver pitcher glistened damply, and the tea was cool and refreshing. Nynaeve admired Elaine's face, cool and dry. She herself already felt moist again despite the breeze. "I must say," she muttered, "I expected a different reception." "Did you really?" Elaine asked. "After the way Van Deen and Adelius treated us?" Nynaeve sighed. "Very well, then. I hoped. I am finally Aes Sedai, really Aes Sedai, and nobody seems to believe it. I truly hoped leaving Salidar would make a difference." Their meeting with Merlilla Siondevin had not gone well, their presentation to her, in truth. Van Deen's introduction had been almost perfunctory, and then they were dismissed, sent away so the real Aes Sedai could talk. Merlilla had said she was sure they wanted to freshen up, but it was a dismissal, with the choice of going like obedient accepted, or refusing like sulky children. Just remembering ruined all Nynaeve's attempts at calm. Sweat began to run down her face. Being sent away was not the worst of it, really. Merlilla was a slender, palely elegant Kyrianan, with glossy black hair and large, liquid eyes, a gray who looked as if nothing had ever surprised her, and nothing ever could. Only those dark eyes had gone wide when told Nynaeve and Elaine were Aes Sedai, and wider still on learning Egwene was the Ammerlin seat. Birgitta as a warder clearly astounded her, though by that time she managed to hold her reaction to one stare and a brief tightening of her lips. Avienda came out of it the easiest. Merlilla gave her only a murmur about how much she would enjoy being a novice. Then came the dismissal, and a suggestion, more in the nature of a command, that they spend several days recuperating from the rigors of their journey. Nynaeve plucked her handkerchief from her sleeve and fanned her face uselessly with the lacy square. "I still think they're hiding something." "Really, Nynaeve," Elaine said, shaking her head. "I do not like how we're being treated any more than you, but you are trying to make a bull out of a mouse. If Van Deen and Adelius want to look for runaways, let them. Would you rather have them trying to take over looking for the bowl?" During the whole journey they had hardly mentioned the Turangrial they sought, for fear the pair would do just that. Whether they would have or not, Nynaeve still thought they were hiding things. Elaine just did not want to admit it. Adelius had not realized that Nynaeve had overheard that remark about looking for runaways once they reached Ebudar, and when Nynaeve asked whether they really expected to find any, Van Deen replied just a bit too quickly that they always kept an eye out for young women who had run from the tower. It did not make sense. No one had run away from Salidar, but novices did run sometimes. The life was hard, especially with years of obedience to look forward to before you could even think of thinking for yourself. And an occasional accepted who had begun to despair of ever reaching the shawl tried to slip away. Yet even Nynaeve knew that few made it off the island of Tarvalen, and almost all were dragged back. You could be put out at any time, for not being strong enough to go on, for refusing or failing your test for accepted, or the test for Aes Sedai that she and Elaine had slipped by, but leaving was never your decision unless you wore the shawl. So, if successful runaways were so rare, why did Van Deen and Adelius think they might find one in Ebu Dar, and why had they shut up like mussels when she asked? She was afraid she knew the answer to the last, anyway. Not tugging her braid required considerable self-control. She thought she was becoming better at that. "At least Matt finally knows where Aes Sedai," she growled. At least she could deal with him now. Let him try anything, and he would see what it was like being thumped with everything she could wrap a flow around. He had better. "Is that why you've been avoiding him like a Chelten flinching from the tax collector?" Birgitta asked with a grin, and Nynaeve felt her face coloring. She thought she had hidden her feelings better than that. "He is very irritating even for a man," Avienda murmured. "You must have traveled very far, Birgitta. You often speak of places I have never heard of. One day I would like to travel the wetlands and see all these strange places. Where is this Chelten, Chelta?" That wiped Brigitte's grin right off. Wherever it was, it might be dead 1,000 years, or since an earlier age altogether. Her and her slipping ancient places and things into the conversation. Nynaeve wished she had been there to see her admit to Egwene what Egwene already knew. Egwene had grown impressively forceful in her time with the Aiel, and put up with little she considered nonsense. Birgitta had actually come back looking chastened. Even so, Nynaeve liked Birgitta rather better than she did Avienda, who made her very uneasy at times with her hard stares and bloodthirsty talk. And however irritating Birgitta could be, Nynaeve had promised to help her keep her secret. "Matt threatened me," she said hurriedly. It was the first way that came to mind to divert Avienda, and the last thing she wanted anyone else to know. Her cheeks heated all over again. Elaine actually smiled, though she had the grace to hide it in her teacup. "Not like that," Nynaeve added, when Avienda began frowning and fingering her belt knife. The Aiel woman seemed to think the proper response to everything was a violent one. "It was just..." Avienda and Birgitta looked at her, all ears and interest. "He just said..." As she had rescued Birgitta, Elaine rescued her. "I really think that is enough about Master Cawthon," Elaine said firmly. "He is only here to pull him out of Egwene's hair, and I can puzzle out what to do about the Tarangrial later." Her lips compressed for a moment. She had not been happy when Van Deen and Adelius began channeling at Matt, without so much as a by your leave, and even less when he slipped off to that inn. There had been nothing she could do, of course. She claimed that by only telling him to do what he had to do anyway in the beginning, she could bring him into the habit. Well, good luck to her. "He is the least important part of this trip," she said, even more firmly. "Yes," Nynaeve just kept the relief out of her voice. "Yes, the bowl is what's important." "I suggest I scout about first," Birgitta said. "Ebu Dar seems rougher than I remember, and the district you describe could be rougher than..." She did not quite glance at Avienda. "Than the rest of the city," she finished with a sigh. "If there is scouting to be done," Avienda put in eagerly, "I wish to be part of it. I have a cut in sore." "A scout is supposed to blend in," Elaine said gently. "I think we should find Ebu Dari dress for all of us. Then we can all search together from the start, and none of us will stand out. Though Nynaeve will have the easiest time of it," she added, smiling at Birgitta and Avienda. The Ebu Dari they had seen so far all had dark hair, and most seemed to have nearly black eyes. Avienda exhaled glumly, and Nynaeve felt like echoing her, thinking of those deep necklines. Very deep, however narrow. Birgitta actually grinned. The woman had no shame at all. Before the discussion could go any further, a woman with short black hair, in the livery of House Mitzobar, entered without knocking, which Nynaeve thought rude no matter what Elaine said was proper for servants. Her dress was white, the skirt sewn up the knee on the left side to expose a green petticoat, with a snug bodice embroidered on the left breast with a green anchor and sword. Even the livery's narrow neckline plunged as far as Nynaeve recalled. Plump, and somewhere in her middle years, the woman hesitated, then curtsied and addressed herself to everyone. "Queen Tylin wishes to see the Three-Eyes Sedai, if it pleases them." Nynaeve exchanged wondering looks with Elaine and the others. "There are only two of us Eyes Sedai here," Elaine said after a moment. "Perhaps you meant to go to Merlilla?" "I was directed to this apartment, Eyes Sedai." The pause was barely long enough to notice, and the woman just missed turning the title into a question. Elaine rose, smoothing her skirts. No stranger would suspect that that smooth face hid anger, but there was a hint of tightness at the corners of eyes and mouth. "Shall we go, then? Nynaeve? Avienda? Brigitte?" "I am not Aes Sedai, Elaine," Avienda said, and the serving woman put in hurriedly, "I was told only the Aes Sedai." "Avienda and I could have a look around the city while you see the queen," Brigitte said, before Elaine could open her mouth. Avienda's face lit up. Elaine gave the pair of them a sharp look, then sighed. "Well, at least be careful. Nynaeve, are you coming? Or do you want to see the city, too?" That last was in a dry tone, with another glance at Brigitte. "Oh, I would not miss it," Nynaeve told her. "It will be good to finally meet someone who thinks—" She could not finish it with the maid there. "We should not keep the queen waiting." "Oh, no," the liveried woman said. "It'd be as much as my ears are worth." However much her ears were worth, it took some time to walk through the palace corridors. As though to make up for all the white outside, the palace was full of color. In one corridor, the ceiling was painted green and the walls blue. In another, the walls were yellow and the ceiling pale rose. The floor tiles were diamonds of red and black and white, or blue and yellow, or almost any combination in any shade. There were very few tapestries, usually scenes of the sea, but a good many tall vases of golden sea-folk porcelain stood in arched niches, and also large pieces of carved crystal, statuettes, and vases and bowls that caught Elaine's eye as well as Nynaeve's. Of course, servants scurried about everywhere, the men's version of the livery entailing white breeches and a long green vest over a white shirt with wide pleated sleeves. But before they had gone very far, Nynaeve saw someone striding toward them who made her stop and catch Elaine's arm. It was Jakim Karadin. She did not take her eyes off the tall, graying man as he strode on past them, those cruel, deep-set eyes never turning in their direction, white cloak spreading behind him. Sweat covered his face, but he ignored it as he ignored them. "What is he doing here?" Nynaeve demanded. That man had unleashed slaughter in Tanchico, and the light only knew where else. The serving woman looked at her quizzically. "Why, the Children of the Light sent an embassy, too, months gone. The queen, Aes Sedai?" Again that hesitation. Elaine managed to nod graciously, but Nynaeve could not blank the asperity from her own voice. "Then we should not keep her waiting." One thing Merlilla had let slip about this Tylin was that she was a punctilious woman, stiffly formal. But if she, too, started doubting they were Aes Sedai, Nynaeve was in just the mood to prove it. The serving woman left them in a large room with a pale blue ceiling and yellow walls, where a row of tall, triple-arched windows gave onto a long, wrought-iron balcony and let in a quite comfortable salty breeze. And before the queen, Nynaeve and Elaine made their curtsies, proper for Aes Sedai to ruler, a slight dip, a tiny bow of the head. Tylin was a most impressive woman. No taller than Nynaeve, she stood with a regal bearing that Elaine would have had to strain to match on her best day. She should have replied to their courtesies with the same, but she did not. Instead, her large black eyes examined them with imperious intensity. Nynaeve returned the favor as well as she could. Waves of glossy black hair, gray at the temples, hung well below Tylin's shoulders, framing a face that was handsome if not unlined. Shockingly, there were two scars on the woman's cheeks, fine and so old they had all but vanished. Of course, she did have one of those curved knives stuck through a belt of woven gold, with hilt and scabbard encrusted in gems. Nynaeve was sure it must be for show. Tylin's blue silk dress was certainly nothing anyone could wear fighting a duel, with falls of snowy lace that would nearly hide her fingers if she lowered her hands, and skirts drawn up above her knees in front to expose layers of green and white silk petticoats, and trailing behind her a pace or more. The bodice, trimmed in the same lace, was snug enough that Nynaeve was not sure whether sitting in it or standing would be more uncomfortable. A collar of woven gold fastened around the gown's high neck, which put more lace under her chin, supported a white-sheathed marriage knife, hanging hilt down into an oval cutout that easily equaled any of those deep necklines. "You two must be Elaine and Nynaeve." Tylin took a chair carved to resemble bamboo, though covered in gilt, and arranged her skirts carefully without taking her eyes from them. Her voice was deep, melodious, and commanding. "I understood there was a third, Avienda." Nynaeve exchanged glances with Elaine. There had been no invitation for them to sit, not so much as a flicker of eyes toward a chair. "She is not Aes Sedai," Elaine began calmly. Tylin spoke before she could say more. "And you are? You've seen 18 winters at most, Elaine. And you, Nynaeve, staring at me like a cat with its tail caught. How many have you seen? 22? 23, perhaps? Stab my liver. I visited Tar Valon once and the White Tower. I doubt any woman your age has ever worn that ring on her right hand." 26, Nynaeve snapped. With a good part of the women's circle back in Emmons Field thinking she was too young to be wisdom, it had become habit with her to flourish every naming day she could claim. "I am 26 and an Aes Sedai of the Yellow Aja." She still felt a thrill of pride saying that. "Elaine may be 18, but she is Aes Sedai as well, and Green Aja. Do you think Merlilla or Van Deen would let us wear these rings as a joke? A good many things have changed, Tylin. The Amarlin seat, Egwene Alvear, is no older than Elaine."
"Is she?" Tylin said in a flat voice. "I was not told that.
When the Aes Sedai who counseled me from the day I took the throne and my father before me abruptly leaves for the tower without explanation, and I then learn that rumors of a tower divided are true, when Dragonsworn seem to spring out of the ground, when an Amarlin is chosen to oppose Elida and an army gathered under one of the great captains inside Altara before I hear of it, when all of that has happened, you cannot expect me to be enamored of surprises." Nynaeve hoped her face did not look as sickly as she felt. Why could she not learn to hold her tongue occasionally? Abruptly she realized she could no longer sense the true source. Anger and embarrassment did not go together very well. It was probably to the good. If she could channel, she might make an even bigger fool of herself. Elaine moved to smooth things over without a pause. "I know you have heard this before," she told Tylin, "but let me add my apologies to those of Merlilla and the others. Gathering an army inside your borders without your permission was unconscionable. All I can say in mitigation is that events moved quickly, and we in Salidar were caught up, but that is no excuse. I swear to you no harm is intended to Altara, and no insult was meant to the Throne of the Winds. Even as we speak, Garth Bryn leads that army north, out of Altara." Tylin stared at her, unblinking.
"I have heard no word of apology or excuse until yours. But any ruler of Altara must learn to swallow insult from greater powers without salt."
Taking a deep breath, she gestured, lace waving.
"Sit. Sit. Both of you sit. Lean back on your knife and let your tongue go free.
Her sudden smile was very close to a grin.
I don't know how you say it in Andor. Be at ease, and speak your mind as you wish.
Nynaeve was glad that Elaine's blue eyes widened in surprise because she herself gasped aloud. This was the woman who Merlilla had claimed required ceremony carved in polished marble? Nynaeve was more than glad to take a chair. Thinking of all the hidden currents in Salidar, she wondered whether Tylin was trying to... To what? She had come to expect everyone who was not a close friend to try manipulating her. Elaine sat on the very front of her chair, and stiffly.
I mean what I say, Tylin insisted. Whatever you say, I will hear no insult.
From the way her fingers tapped the jeweled hilt at her waist, though, silence might be heard as one.
I am not certain where to begin, Nynaeve said carefully.
She did wish Elaine had not actually nodded at that. Elaine was supposed to know how to handle kings and queens. Why did she not say something?
With why, the queen said impatiently. Why do 4 more Aes Sedai come to Ebu Dar from Salidar? It cannot be to outshine Elida's embassy. Teslin does not even call it that, and there are only her and Jolene.
You did not know? Falling back in her chair, laughing, she pressed the fingers of one hand to her lips.
Do you know about the white cloaks?
Yes? Her free hand made a slashing gesture, and her mirth began to subside in small ripples.
That for white cloaks. But I must listen to all who court me. Lord Inquisitor Caradin, as well as the others.
But why? Nynaeve demanded.
I am glad you don't like white cloaks, but in that case why must you listen to a word Caradin says? The man's a butcher.
She knew she had made another mistake. The way Elaine suddenly seemed to be studying the broad white fireplace where the deep lintel was carved into towering waves told her that, even before the last vestige of Tylin's laughter snuffed out like a candle.
You take me at my word, the queen said quietly. I said let your tongue go free, and...
Those dark eyes went to the floor tiles, and she seemed to be gathering herself. Nynaeve looked to Elaine, hoping for some hint of what she had done wrong, or better, how to make it right. But Elaine only gave her one sideways glance and the smallest shake of her head before returning to her study of the marble waves. Maybe she should avoid looking at Tylin, too? Yet the woman staring at the floor drew her eyes. With one hand, Tylin stroked the hilt of her curved dagger. With the other, fingered the smaller hilt nestled between her breasts. The marriage dagger told quite a lot about Tylin. Van Deen and Adelius had been more than willing to explain some things concerning Ebu Dar, usually those that made the city seem unsafe for anyone not surrounded by a dozen armored guards. The white sheath meant the queen was widowed and did not intend to remarry. The 4 pearls and 1 fire drop set in the gold-wrapped hilt said she had borne 4 sons and 1 daughter. The white enameled setting of the fire drop and the red enameled of 3 of the pearls said only 1 son survived. All had been at least 16 when they died, and died in duels, or the settings would have been black. What must it be like to constantly carry a reminder of that sort? According to Van Deen, women saw a red or white setting as a source of pride, whether her stones were pearls and fire drops or colored glass. Van Deen said many Ebu Dari women removed the stones of their children past 16 who refused a duel and never acknowledged them again. At long last, Tylin raised her head. Her face was pleasant, and her hand left the dagger in her belt, but she continued to finger the marriage knife absently.
I want my son to follow me on the throne of the winds, she said mildly. Beslan is your age, Elaine. This would be a matter of course in Andor, though he would have to be a woman.
She actually grinned, in apparently genuine amusement.
Or in any other land save Murundi, where matters are much the same as here in Altara. In the 1,000 years since Ardor Hawkwing, only 1 house has held the throne for 5 generations, and Anarina's fall was so precipitous
that to this day House Todand is a lapdog for anyone who wants them. No other house has ever had more than two rulers in succession. When my father took the throne, other houses had more of the city itself than Mitsubar. Had he stepped outside this palace without guards, he would have been sewn into a sack with rocks and tossed into the river. When he died, he gave me what I have now. Small compared to other rulers. A man riding fresh horses could reach the end of my writ in one day's hard ride. I have not been idle, though. When news of the Dragon Reborn came, I was certain I could hand on to Beslan twice what I hold, and allies of a sort beyond that. The Stone of Tyr and Kalendor changed everything. Now I thank Pedro Nile when he arranges for Ilion to take a 100-mile swath of Altara instead of invading. I listen to Jaqim Caradhan, and I do not spit in his eye, however many Altarans died in the White Cloak War. I listen to Caradhan, and to Teslin, and to Merlilla, and I pray that I can pass something to my son instead of being found drowned in my bath on the day Beslan meets with an accident hunting. Tylan drew a long breath. The pleasant face remained, but an edge entered her voice. Now, I have stood bare-breasted in the fish market for you. Answer me mine. Why do I have the honor of four more Aes Sedai?
We are here to find a Tarangrial, Elaine said. And as Nynaeve stared in amazement, she told everything from Telairunriod to the dust in the room where the bowl was.
To make the weather right again would be a miraculous blessing, Tylan said slowly. But the quarter you describe sounds like the Rahad across the river. Even the civil guard steps lightly there. Forgive me, I understand that you are Aes Sedai, but in the Rahad you could have a knife in your back before you knew it. If the clothes are fine, they use a very narrow blade, so there is little blood. Perhaps you should leave this search to Van Deen and Adelius. I think they have had a few more years than you to see such places.
They told you about the bowl? Nynaeve said with a frown, but the queen shook her head.
Only that they were here to search for something. Aes Sedai never tell a word more than they absolutely must. Once again that sudden grin flashed. It looked quite merry, though it did make her scars show as thin lines across her cheeks.
Until you two, at least. May the years not change you too much. I often wish Kavandra had not returned to the tower. I could talk with her in this way.
Standing, she motioned them to remain seated and glided across the room to tap a silver gong with an ivory mallet. It produced quite a loud chime for such a small cylinder.
I will send for cool mint tea and we will talk. You will tell me how I can help. If I send soldiers into the Rahad, it will be the wine riots all over again. And perhaps you will even be able to explain why the bay is full of seafolk ships that neither dock nor trade.
A goodly time passed over tea and talk, mostly about the dangers of the Rahad and what Tylan could not do, and Beslan was brought in, a soft-spoken youth who bowed respectfully and stared with beautiful black eyes that perhaps held relief when his mother said he could go. He certainly never doubted they were Aes Sedai. Finally, though, the pair of them were finding their way back to their apartment through the brightly painted corridors.
So they mean to take over the search, too, Nynaeve murmured, glancing about to make sure none of the liveried servants was close enough to hear.
Tylan had known too much about them too soon, and however she grinned, she'd been upset over the Aes Sedai in Salidar.
Elaine, do you think it was wise to tell her everything? She might decide the best way to make sure that boy gets the throne is to let us find the bowl and then tell Teslin.
She remembered Teslin slightly, a red and an unpleasant woman.
I know how my mother felt about Aes Sedai traveling about Andor, never letting her know what they were doing. I know how I would feel. Besides, I finally remembered being taught about that phrase, lean back on your knife and the rest. The only way to insult somebody who says that to you is to lie.
Elaine's chin rose slightly.
As for Van Deen and Adelius, they only think they've taken over. This Rahad may be dangerous, but I cannot think it is any worse than Tanchico, and we won't have the Black Aja to worry about. I wager in 10 days we will have the bowl. I will know what makes Math's Turangrial do what it should not be able to do, and we will be on our way to join Egwene, with him knuckling his forehead as fast as Master Vanin, and Vandine and Adelius will be left sitting here with Merlilla and Teslin, trying to puzzle out what happened. Nynaeve could not help it. She laughed out loud. A lanky serving man shifting a large vase of golden porcelain stared at her, and she stuck out her tongue at him. He nearly dropped the vase. "I won't take that wager, except about Matt. 10 days it is."
Chapter 49 The Mirror of Mists. Rand puffed contentedly on his pipe, sitting in his shirt sleeves with his back against one of the slender white columns that surrounded the small oval courtyard, and watched the waters spray up in the marble fountain, sparkling like gems in the sunlight. The morning still left this part of the courtyard in pleasant shade. Even Luce Theron was still. "Are you sure you won't reconsider Tyr?" Seated against the next column, and also coatless, Perrin blew 2 smoke rings before replacing his pipe, a rather ornate thing carved with wolf heads. "What about what Min saw?" Rand's attempt at his own ring ran afoul of a sour grunt and came off just a puff of smoke. Min had had no right to bring that up where Perrin could hear. "Do you really want to be tied to my belt, Perrin?" "What I want hasn't seemed to count much since the first time we saw Moraine back in Emmons Field," Perrin said dryly. He sighed. "You are who you are, Rand. If you fail, everything fails." Suddenly he sat forward, frowning toward a wide doorway behind the columns to their left. A long moment later, Rand heard footsteps in that direction, too heavy for any human. The broad shape that ducked through the doorway and strode into the courtyard was more than twice as tall as the serving woman, who was almost running to keep up with the Ogier's long legs. "Loyal!" Rand exclaimed, scrambling to his feet. He and Perrin reached the Ogier together. The grin on Loyal's wide mouth really did almost split his huge face in two, but his long coat, spreading out above turned-down knee-high boots, still carried travel dust. The big pockets bulged with squarish shapes, too. Loyal was never far from books. "Are you all right, Loyal?" "You look tired," Perrin said, urging the Ogier toward the fountain. "Sit on the coping." Loyal let himself be led, but his long dangling eyebrows rose and tufted ears quivered in puzzlement as he stared from one of them to the other. Sitting, he was as tall as Perrin standing.
"All right. Tired?"
His voice was a rumble like the earth moving.
"Of course I'm all right. And if I'm tired, I've walked a long way. I must say it felt good to be back on my own feet. You always know where your feet are taking you, but you never can be sure with a horse. Anyway, my feet are faster."
Abruptly he let out a thunderous laugh.
"You owe me a gold crown, Perrin. You and your 10 days. I'll wager another crown you've not been here more than 5 days before me."
"You'll get your crown," Perrin laughed. In an aside to Rand that had Loyal's ears vibrating indignantly, he added, "Gaul corrupted him. He dices now, and bets on horse races when he can barely tell one horse from another." Rand grinned. Loyal always had looked at horses rather dubiously, and small wonder since his legs were longer than theirs. "Are you sure you're all right, Loyal?" "Did you find that abandoned steading?" Perrin asked around his pipe stem. "Did you stay long enough?"
"What are you two talking about?"
Loyal's uncertain frown trailed the ends of his eyebrows down onto his cheeks.
"I just wanted to see a steading again, to feel one. I am ready for 10 more years.
"That isn't what your mother says," Rand said seriously. Loyal was on his feet before Rand finished, staring wildly in every direction, ears laid back and trembling.
"My mother? Here? She is here?"
"No, she isn't," Perrin said, and Loyal's ears almost went limp with relief.
It seems she's in the Two Rivers, or was a month ago. Rand used some way of hopping about he has to take her and Elder Hammond. What's the matter?
Halfway to sitting down again, Loyal froze with his knees bent at Elder Hammond's name. Eyes closed, he lowered himself slowly the rest of the way.
Elder Hammond,
he muttered, rubbing his face with a thick-fingered hand.
Elder Hammond and my mother.
He peered at Perrin. He peered at Rand. In a voice that was low and much too casual, he asked,
Was anyone else with them?
Well, it was low for an Ogier, a giant bumblebee buzzing in a huge water jar. A young Ogier woman named Aerith, Rand told him. You... That was as far as he got. With a moan, Loyal leaped to his feet again. Servants' heads appeared at doorways and windows to see what that vast noise was, and vanished again when they saw Rand. Loyal began pacing back and forth, ears and eyebrows both drooping so much that he seemed to be melting.
A wife, he mumbled. It cannot mean anything else, not with Mother and Elder Hammond. A wife. I'm too young to get married.
Rand hid a smile behind his hand. Loyal might be young for an Ogier, but in his case, that meant more than 90.
She'll drag me back to staying Shangtai. I know she won't let me travel with you, and I still don't have near enough notes for my book. Oh, you can smile, Perrin. Fael does whatever you say.
Perrin choked on his pipe, wheezing until Rand slapped his back.
It is different with us,
Loyal went on.
It is considered very rude not to do as your wife says. Very rude. I know she'll make me settle down to something solid and respectable, like tree singing or...
Abruptly he frowned and stopped pacing.
Did you say Aerith?
Rand nodded. Perrin seemed to be getting his breath back, but he was glaring at Loyal in a sort of malevolent amusement.
Aerith, daughter of Iva, daughter of Aelar?
Rand nodded again, and Loyal sank back to his place in the fountain coping.
But I know her. You remember her, Rand. We met her at Stedding Tsofu.
That was what I was trying to tell you, Rand said patiently, and with no little amusement himself. She was the one who said you're handsome, and gave you a flower, as I recall.
She might have said,
Loyal muttered defensively.
She might have done. I cannot recall.
But one hand strayed toward a coat pocket full of books, where Rand would have wagered anything, that flower was carefully pressed. The Ogier cleared his throat, a deep rumble.
Aerith is very beautiful. I've never seen anyone so beautiful. And intelligent. She listened very attentively when I explained Cerdan's theory. That is, Cerdan, son of Colom, son of Radlin. He wrote about 600 years ago. When I explained his theory of how the ways...
He trailed off as if he had just noticed their grins.
Well, she did listen. Attentively. She was very interested.
I'm sure she was, Rand said noncommittally. Mention of the ways made him think. Most of the waygates were near Stedding, and if Loyal's mother and Elder Hammond were to be believed, the Stedding were what Loyal needed. Of course, he could not take Loyal any closer than the edge of one. You could not channel into a Stedding any more than you could channel inside one. Listen, Loyal. I want to put guards on all the waygates, and I need somebody who can not only find them, but can talk to the elders as well and get their permission.
Light, Perrin growled disgustedly.
He tapped out his pipe and ground the dottle into the courtyard paving stone under his boot heel.
Light. You send Matt off to face down Aes Sedai. You want to dump me into the middle of a war with Samael and a few hundred Two Rivers men with me, some of them you know. And now you want to send Loyal off when he's only just arrived. Burn you, Rand, look at him. He needs rest. Is there anybody you won't use? Maybe you want Fael to go hunt Mogedion or Semirag. Light!
Anger welled up in Rand, a tempest that made him shake. Those yellow eyes stared at him grimly, but he stared back like thunder.
I will use anybody I must. You said it yourself, I am who I am. And I'm using myself up, Perrin, because I have to, just like I'll use anybody I have to.
We don't have a choice anymore. Not me, not you, not anybody.
Rand, Perrin,
Loyal murmured worriedly.
Be still, be calm. Don't fight. Not you.
A hand the size of a ham patted each of them awkwardly on the shoulder.
You should both rest in the steading. The steading are very peaceful, very soothing.
Rand stared at Perrin, staring at him. Anger still flashed in him, lightning flashes in a storm that would not quite die. Lutheran's mutters rumbled fitfully far off. I'm sorry, he muttered, meaning it for both. Perrin made an offhand gesture, maybe meaning there was nothing to apologize for, maybe accepting the apology, but he did not offer one himself. Instead, his head swung toward the columns again, toward the door Loyal had come through. Once more, moments passed before Rand heard running footsteps. Min dashed into the courtyard at a dead run. Ignoring Loyal and Perrin, she seized Rand's arms. They're coming, she panted. They're on their way right now. Easy, Min, Rand said. Calm yourself. I was beginning to think they were all taking to their beds like... What did you say her name was? Demira? In truth, he felt considerable relief, though Luz Theron's grumblings and wheezing laughter grew louder with the mention of Aes Sedai. For 3 days, Marana had appeared with two sisters each afternoon as regular as the finest clockmaker's art. But the visits had suddenly stopped 5 days ago without a word of explanation. Min had no idea why. He had been worried that they had taken offense enough at his rules to leave. But Min stared up at him with a face of anguish. She was trembling, he realized. Listen to me. It is 7 of them, not 3, and they didn't send me to ask permission or to let you know or anything. I slipped out ahead of them and galloped Wildrose the whole way. They mean to be inside the palace before you know they're here. I heard Marana talking to Demira when they didn't know I was there. They mean to reach the Grand Hall ahead of you, so you have to come to them.
Is this your viewing, do you think? He asked calmly. Women who could channel would hurt him badly, she had said.
7, Luz Theron whispered hoarsely. No, no, no.
Rand ignored him. There was little else he could do.
I don't know, Min said in an agonized voice.
Rand was startled to realize the shine in her dark eyes came from unshed tears.
Do you think I wouldn't tell you if I knew? All I know is they are coming and...
And there is nothing to be afraid of, he broke in firmly. The Aes Sedai must really have frightened her for Min to be near crying.
7,
Luz Theron groaned.
I cannot handle 7. Not at once. Not 7.
Rand thought of the fat little man Angrial, and the voice faded to murmurs. It still sounded uneasy, though. At least Alana was not one of them. Rand could feel her at some distance, not moving, certainly not toward him. He was not sure he dared come face to face with her again.
There's no time to waste, either. Jelani!
The plump-cheeked young maiden popped out from behind a column so suddenly that Loyal's ears shot straight up. Min seemed to see the Ogier for the first time, and Perrin. She gave a start, too.
Jelani, Rand said, tell Nandera I am going to the Grand Hall, where I expect Aes Sedai shortly.
She tried to maintain a smooth face, but the beginnings of a self-satisfied grin made her cheeks seem even plumper.
Berelna has already gone to inform Nandera, Ka'akarn.
Loyal's ears flickered in surprise at the title.
Then would you tell Sulan to meet me at the dressing rooms behind the Grand Hall with my coat and the dragon scepter?
Jelani's grin widened openly.
Sulan has already gone running in her wetlander dress as fast as a gray-nosed hare that sat on Sagata spines.
In that case, Rand said, you can bring my horse to the Grand Hall.
The young maiden's jaw dropped, especially when Perrin and Loyal doubled over laughing. Min's fist in Rand's short ribs made him grunt.
This is no joking matter, you thick-skulled sheep farmer. Marana and the rest were wrapping themselves in their shawls as though putting on armor. Now listen to me. I will stand over to one side behind the column so you can see, and they cannot. And if I see anything, I'll make some sort of signal.
You will stay here with Loyal and Perrin, he told her.
I don't know what kind of signal you could make that I'd understand, and if they catch even a glimpse of you, they will know you warned me.
She gave him one of those fist-on-hips, glaring up through her eyelashes, sullen, stubborn stares.
Men? To his surprise, she sighed and said,
"Yes, Rand,"
just as meek as milk water. That sort of thing from her made him as suspicious as it would have from Elaine or Avienda, but he had no time for digging if he was to be in the grand hall before Mirana. Nodding, he hoped he did not look as uncertain as he felt. Wondering whether he should have asked Perrin and Loyal to keep her there, she would have loved that, he trotted all the way to the dressing rooms behind the grand hall with Jelani at his heels, muttering about whether the horse had been a joke. Sulin was already there, with a gold-embroidered red coat and the dragon scepter. The spearhead got an approving grunt, though no doubt she would have found it more acceptable without the green and white tassel, and with a proper length of shaft and no carvings. Rand felt to be sure the Angrial was in the pocket. It was, and he breathed more easily, though Luce Theron still seemed to be panting anxiously. When Rand hurried through one of the lion-paneled dressing rooms into the grand hall, he discovered that everyone had been as quick as Sulin. Bale towered at one side of the throne dais with his arms folded, while Melaine stood on the other, calmly adjusting her dark shawl. What must have been 100 or more maidens lined the way from the doors on one knee, under Nandera's watchful gaze, complete with spears and bucklers, hornbows cased on their backs, and full quivers at their hips. Only their eyes showed above black veils. Jelani ran to join one of those lines. Behind them, more Aiel crowded among the thick columns, men and maidens, though none appeared armed beyond their heavy-bladed knives. There were a number